We'll hear arguments first this afternoon in number 86656, Ronald Reagan versus James Aberesk. You may proceed whenever you're ready, Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. These cases, which were consolidated in the District Court, present questions concerning the denial on foreign policy grounds of non-immigrant visas to aliens invited by persons or groups in this country to participate in public or academic discussions. The denials were based on a provision that appears on page 2 of our brief, subsection 27 of the list of provisions in section 1182 of Title 8, which are provisions of bases for excluding aliens from the issuance of visas. And in this instance, they were denied as prejudicial to the public interest or endangering the welfare, safety, or security of the United States. The Court of Appeals held, and it is not contested in this court, that foreign policy concerns can be a proper basis for a denial under subsection 27, that something detrimental to our foreign policy interests would be within the broad formulation of prejudicial to the public interest or endangering the welfare of the United States. And the statutory issues that remain in the case are whether that denial can be based on a detriment to our foreign policy that flows from the very presence or entry of the alien into this country, or whether it must be based strictly on something detrimental about the particular activities in which he plans to engage, and whether, if that question is answered favorably to the government, the authority that we would then have to deny the visas under subsection 27 has been abrogated by what is commonly called the McGovern Amendment, which amended another provision of section 1182, subsection 28. Before...
May I ask, Mr. Wallace, I gather you have to persuade us that to engage in activities is virtually meaningless, don't you?
Well, I would not characterize my burden that way, Mr. Justice. Obviously,
what does it mean, do you think?
Well, there are two ways of looking at it that support our position. The one that has been more commonly used in this litigation is to say that presence or entry into the United States are themselves activities. That's a little difficult to reconcile with the words to engage in activities, but it's not beyond the pale in light of the legislative history. Another way, which I think may be more helpful, is to say that, yes, they are admitted to engage in activities, and that those activities, while not detrimental to the public interest if engaged in by somebody else, would be detrimental to the public interest if engaged in by this individual, because it would involve his presence or entry into the United States.
Well, but in this
to engage in those.
In this case, as I understand it, there's no evidence whatever they had any intention of engaging in any activities. This rests, does it not, entirely on the fact that they were members of, what, the Communist Party?
Various organizations. In one instance, the government of Nicaragua.
Yes.
In other instances, the Federation of Cuban Women, and in the third instance, a group called the World Peace Council, which was founded
by reason of their association with one or the other or more of those organizations, that they were said to be excludable under the statute, isn't it?
It was by reason of that, coupled with the State Department's determination that these organizations are instruments of a particular foreign government, and that it would be disadvantageous to our conduct of foreign policy to admit someone for the purpose of carrying on that organization's program in the activities in which they want to engage in the United States, it would be detrimental to our foreign policy interests to extend our hospitality to these individuals by the issuance of a non-immigrant visa to engage in these activities.
Mr. Wallace, it's charged that they were going to engage in those activities in this country?
That is correct. I mean, that they wish to enter the country to engage in activities. I mean,
like
anyone who wants to enter the country wants to engage in activities.
Like what?
In this case, it's
making a speech?
That is correct, and to participate in discussions.
That's freedom of speech.
Undoubtedly, when engaged in by somebody properly present.
There's nothing other than speech involved.
Our position is there need not be any misconduct in the activities themselves for subsection 27 to apply. The activities might even be constitutionally protected activities, but subsection 27 nonetheless applies if the presence or entry of the individual to engage in those activities would be detrimental to our foreign policy interests. And that
Is it critical to your position that the activities be activities that could be attributed to the organizations with which the three people were associated?
Well, it
seemed to suggest that in an earlier state.
It is a part of our position.
Then it isn't a case of mere presence or mere entry. It's your proof is that these people were engaged in activities on behalf of some organization.
That is correct.
That's a different theory than the dissent below, I think.
Well, the dissent authorizes in its theory a broader use of subsection 27 than we're actually making of it.
So you're not espousing the theory of the dissent.
Well, I'm not disassociating myself from it, but we don't have to go as far as some of the implications of the dissenting opinion.
So you're not arguing that mere presence and mere entry is an activity within the meaning of section 27.
Well,
are you? I mean,
that is one of our alternative contentions, yes, that we have the authority to decide that mere entry or mere presence is an activity that in itself is detrimental to our foreign policy interests. But in administering the statute, the fact of the matter is we look at the activities in which they propose to engage before making the determination of whether entry or presence would be detrimental to our foreign policy. But we do so in a very limited way. In other words, we allow individuals to enter, even though we might deny them entry for this purpose, but we would allow them to enter, and we've allowed some of these same individuals to enter, including Olga Finlay, to attend meetings of an international body, such as the United Nations. We would allow them to enter for limited purposes. We would allow them
Is there a finding here that it was the activities in which they intended to engage that explain the reason for their exclusion?
There were affidavits submitted.
I said, is there a finding to that effect?
The finding by the district judge is that We had facially valid foreign policy reasons for denying their entry, which under this court's decision in Kleindienst against Mandel, he has no right to look behind and make a finding with respect to.
Is the facially valid reason the fact that their mere presence or mere entry would be detrimental, or is it that the activities in which they would engage would be detrimental? What is the finding?
I can't say that the district judge's finding is articulated so as to draw that distinction, as I recall it. It would be at the very...
It makes a great deal of difference in the...
I'm looking at page 80A of the joint appendix, where the district court merely says it has concluded that facially legitimate reasons exist for denying visas to the four individuals whose entry is being sought in these actions. They were not denied entry because of the content of the expected speeches, but because of their personal status as officials of governments or organizations which are hostile to the United States. But the affidavits on which he relies do state as part of the reasons why their entry would be detrimental to our foreign policy interests is because it is entry to function as representatives of, in Mr. Borges' case, in the case of the Cuban women, of organizations controlled by the Nicaraguan or Cuban governments, and in Mr. Pasti's case, to further the program of an organization controlled by the Soviet Union. That is necessarily related to the kinds of activities that they propose to engage in. But the distinction we make with respect to activities is not that someone submits the speech that he's planning to give and a board of censors sits at the State Department and reads the speech and decides whether giving that speech is detrimental to our foreign policy interests. It is a distinction between entry for the limited purposes I started to describe to you, to attend an international meeting of a body that meets in the United States, to conduct bilateral discussions with representatives of the United States, humanitarian entry, such as to get medical treatment, to attend a family funeral. We would allow people in for those purposes, but not extend our general hospitality to them of providing them with a non-immigrant visa, because as the affidavits explained in the case of...
Mr. Wallace, the thing that troubles me, you're telling me what the affidavits say, but the finding just relates to the personal status of the three people. I would think it would apply to going to a funeral, but because they were not denied because of the content of their expected speeches, but because of their personal status as officials of governments or organizations which are hostile to the United States. I would think that would apply if they wanted to come in and have lunch.
But the finding was made based on affidavits that explain the reasons.
Just ask you, is it necessary for us to support your position to go behind the finding and rely on what's in the affidavits instead of what the finding says?
Well, I think it is. I would say it is necessary to read the finding in light of the affidavits on which the finding is based, because the finding is very succinctly stated. The finding is very responsive to this court's holding in Kleindienst against Mandel, that the courts are not to go behind facially legitimate reasons that have been given. And he's relying on the affidavits as the facially legitimate reasons. And in a sense, the finding incorporates the affidavits, if I may say so. And I don't think the district court's decision can be read without reference to the affidavits.
We have the affidavits.
They're in the joint appendix and the classified ones that he refers to are in the appendix to the petition for certiorari. Because they were declassified reprinted there
Mr. Wallace,
toward the end of
when you speak about a finding in this case, Actually, the district court granted summary judgment for the government, didn't it?
That is correct.
So you're not talking about a finding in the ordinary sense of a finding of fact at a bench trial.
That is correct. It granted summary judgment. It concluded that there were no material issues of fact that it had to resolve in light of the facially legitimate reasons given by the government in this series of affidavits for the exclusion. And
Mr. Wallace, may I ask whether you agree with the dissent in the court below that Kleindienst versus Mandel necessarily upheld the constitutionality of the exclusion of communists based on their political beliefs? Do you agree that that was the necessary holding of Mandel?
I don't read Kleindienst against Mandel as necessarily holding that. Mm-hmm. It said there was a facially legitimate reason for that particular exclusion because Professor Mandel had violated restrictions on his visa in past entries, and that was a sufficient basis to uphold the denial of the visa here and to override any First Amendment claim that was implicated on behalf of those who invited him. So I cannot say that we can read Kleindienst against Mandel as having resolved that question so definitively. With respect, I have to say that's slightly overstated in that dissenting opinion. The reasons given in these affidavits do relate to specific foreign policy concerns, and we have summarize them briefly in our brief. Let me say that with respect to those who would be entering here as representatives of an organization and to further the purposes of an organization controlled by the Cuban government, the reference was to our country's policy of trying to diminish the disruptive influence of the Cuban government in Latin America that is detrimental to the conduct of our foreign policy, and that extending hospitality to representatives of that government for purposes of participating in discussions in the United States would contribute to giving that government an aura of legitimacy that would enhance that government's ability to undermine our foreign policy objectives in Central America.
But do you need our courts for that purpose? To enforce public policy in foreign governments and to prevent foreign governments?
We did not need the court, and we were not the one who invoked the court's jurisdiction. We were sued in this case, Mr. Justice.
Well, we
simply denied the visa.
You want us to say that the court can approve the denial of an entry of somebody who is going to make a speech because the State Department doesn't like the country or the person?
Because the State Department thinks it's detrimental, has concluded that it would be detrimental to our foreign policy to extend our hospitality to that person with a non-immigrant visa, and that was within the authority of the Department of State to do. With respect to the Interior Minister of Nicaragua, rather similar reasons were given, having to do with the undermining of our efforts to achieve a peaceful settlement of hostilities in Central America. Should we, at the time, extend our hospitality to the Interior Minister of that state with which we were, to some extent, in an adversarial relationship? With respect to Mr. Poste, an active member of the World Peace Council, which the State Department had determined to be a Soviet-controlled organization, at the time he was coming, that organization was engaged in a vigorous campaign to undermine support within Western Europe for the deployment of American missiles, partly through a campaign of disinformation that is elaborated upon in an attachment to one of Undersecretary Eagleburg's affidavits. And he was an active member coming to further the purposes of that campaign, which was aimed at achieving unilateral disarmament to the extent of not deploying those particular missile systems in Europe, and obviously extending our hospitality to him for that purpose would have a tendency to encourage that organization's efforts and contribute to its esprit for that purpose. These matters change over time. These are now missiles that are currently the subject of negotiation between the Soviet Union and ourselves for the possibility of some mutual withdrawal of the missiles. But these determinations have to be made in the context of the times on which they actually occur. I think some further insight into the problems of this case can be had by looking at the statistics we collected on page 6 of our brief in the footnote, which are also based on an affidavit in this record, that show in the 20-year period, and this is footnote 2 on page 6, from 1963 to 1983, consular officers issued nearly 70 million non-immigrant visas and denied on either foreign policy or internal security grounds under subsection 27 only 519 applications. And in the most recent times, 1981 through 1983, 6 to 7 million per year have been granted, and an average of less than 30 have been denied. This in itself is reflective of the consistent dominant thrust of our foreign policy, which is to encourage in all countries, including our own, because reciprocity is a very important consideration in foreign policy, to encourage freedom of travel through non-immigrant visas, and indeed even to encourage freedom of emigration. It's a policy that not only reflects our ideals about free interchange of persons and ideas, but it is further supported from the likelihood of reexamination by the very practical consideration that in our country there is already a much greater diversity of views being expressed than is true in many countries, and it would not be to our ultimate advantage overall to be opposing travel by persons who might express diverse views, because we tend to benefit much more from additional views being expressed in other countries through travel than it would be at all practical to hope to monitor the expression of views in our country. We don't know what these 70 million people might say when they arrive here. There were only a very minute number of people that we had reason to keep out because of foreign policy concerns of the type I mentioned with respect to these particular applicants. We have in the joint appendix some other examples. This is on pages 111 to 114. the earliest examples that became known of the use of denials for foreign policy reasons. Most of these do not become known because there's a statutory inhibition on public disclosure of them. But these were three examples that indeed had come to the attention of Congress. One was a denial of a visa to a Mr. Liao, a proponent of an independent Formosa. Another was a denial to Mr. Otto Skorzeny, a former Nazi SS officer. And the objection to him was based on the detrimental foreign policy ramifications of granting our hospitality to him, regardless of any particular activities that he might be planning to engage in. The other mentioned is Madame Nu. The problems that the State Department is faced with have to do with factions in exile, factions that may be engaged in armed resistance to governments, deposed former heads of state.
About the Nazi who was Skorzeny, I think you referred to, that was back in 1959. Isn't it true that a few years later they amended the statute to provide a new section that covered the people of that status?
People who were associated with the Nazi regime during the 30s and World War II, but it does not cover people who engaged in brutality while in office in other countries at other times, and there are many such people.
No, but I was just wondering, if you're correctly interpreting 27, I wonder, and you give us an example, this Skorzeny, why did they need to enact 33? Why did they...
Perhaps it was done for emphasis. It didn't necessarily mean that Congress thought that 27 was misapplied with respect to Mr. Skorzeny, and we have taken the position right along that we can apply it with respect to others who have engaged in physical brutality, which are not embraced while in office, which were not embraced within subsection 33. There have been deposed governments in many countries. I don't want to create international incidents by mentioning some of them, where we might very well deny, on foreign policy grounds, the entry of these persons. This has not been disputed by the other side, nor do they deny our basic proposition that it's not necessary for the activities to be in themselves misconduct, because they point to the case of a Libyan young person denied entry to study aircraft maintenance and engineering as a proper example of the use of Section 27. But there's nothing inherently wrong about studying that. And certainly having a willing student attend one's class is a part of academic freedom. The First Amendment interests are implicated in such a case. The problem is the detrimental consequences to our foreign policy. In a case like that, where you're dealing with a non-prominent person, the particular nature of the activities looms as a larger consideration. But in the case of prominent people, such as are involved in our case, what really looms large on the foreign policy call is whether extending our hospitality to them at all is going to be detrimental to our foreign policy. And let me say that once it's concluded, as we submit, that subsection 27 authorizes us to exclude persons on these grounds, it seems clear to us that the McGovern Amendment isn't meant to take that away. It says on its face that it applies only to persons otherwise admissible to the United States. And the legislative history we've recounted, particularly in connection with an amendment to the McGovern Amendment, shows that it has always been understood not to diminish the authority that we had under subsection 27 specifically. The chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee made that point, as we've recounted in our brief. I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Shapiro.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I think it is obvious from the government's argument that the issues raised in this case are critical ones in a constitutional democracy. Whether and to what extent the government may bar foreign speakers from addressing American audiences in the United States on issues of obvious and substantial public concern. As the government points out, and I just want to reiterate because I think it is important to an analysis of the case, there are two separate but related statutory questions before the Court today. One is whether A27, Section 212A27, applies in the absence of any allegation by the government that the excluded foreign speaker is likely to engage in prejudicial activities if admitted to the United States. The second question, which the government barely reached in its argument, is whether the executive may circumvent the congressional restrictions embodied in the McGovern Amendment by using an alien's organizational membership as the basis for exclusion under A27. I must say I am somewhat flabbergasted by Mr. Wallace's argument today, which apparently abandons the principal legal contention that the government has advanced in this case from day one. That is, until 30 minutes ago, the government's position in this case was that an alien could be excluded, a foreign speaker could be excluded from the United States based on the contention that his or her mere entry or presence in the United States were prejudicial to the public interest. That was the government's phrase, not ours, that the alien's mere entry or presence in the United States would be prejudicial to the public interest. That argument, as the Court of Appeals found, as the government now apparently concedes, is simply impossible to square with either the language or history of A27. Indeed, the extent to which the government has at least until today, construed its authority under A27 is illustrated by the example of Nino Pasti. Pasti is a former NATO general, a former Italian senator, worked in the Pentagon for 3 years as a liaison between the Italian Armed Services and the United States Armed Services. In 1983, he was invited to address at this armament rally on Boston Commons by a American peace group, and he was denied a visa on the grounds that the government feared he would spread disinformation if permitted to enter the United States and give his views on the propriety of American missiles in Europe. The statute we are dealing with, A27, quite plainly speaks to the requirement of activities.
The government has abandoned its prior position in favor of what? How do you understand its argument?
The way I understand its argument now, Your Honor, and I must say there were seeds of this in its brief. Its previous argument was it did not need to allege any activities, and indeed it has not alleged any activities. Not only is there no finding of prejudicial activities by any of the courts who have ruled on this question below, if you in fact look at the affidavits submitted by the government, either their original public affidavits or their originally classified and now declassified affidavits, you will not see any reference to prejudicial activities. What you will see is a conclusion that the alien's mere entry or presence in the United States is prejudicial. What I now understand the government to be saying is a claim of mere entry or presence is not sufficient under A27, but we have more. And they say this in their brief, since after all, any alien who enters the country necessarily engages in some activities. And the activities that they cite in their brief as an illustration of that legal contention are every alien eats, sleeps, travels in the United States. Those are activities sufficient to invoke A27. I think that that is equally a fallacious ruling of A27, since A27 doesn't require some activities. It requires activities prejudicial to the public interest. The government has not claimed that the sleeping or eating is prejudicial to the public interest. It's just another way of restating a position which I think the government now understands they cannot sustain. And that
I understood the government's position, particularly with respect to someone like Mr. Borga, as being that a highly placed official of the Sandinista government, anything he did in this country would be prejudicial. Just his presence here would be.
Just his presence would be here, you're right. That's exactly their position, Your Honor, that what he does...
What's your answer to that?
That what he does is irrelevant, that merely his presence in the United States is prejudicial. My answer to that is, and visa denial based on that allegation was never authorized or contemplated by Congress when they adopted Section 212A27, because Section 212A27 provides that an alien may be excluded if there is reason to believe that they will engage in prejudicial activities, not if there is reason to believe that their presence in the United States may be prejudicial to United States foreign policy interests.
Well, you're saying then that there can't be someone of sufficiently bad omen for our foreign policy that anything he does in this country.
I'm saying that is not a 27 exclusion. As we said in the court below, and we continue to believe there are other provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act, including Section 212F of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which may well permit the government under certain circumstances to exclude somebody because their mere presence in the United States is prejudicial to foreign policy interests. But those other sections of the Act are hinged in by other procedural protections that Congress has provided, namely in the case of 212F, the requirement of a presidential finding, to make sure that our government is not excluding foreign speakers based merely on a bureaucratic judgment that their speeches in the United States are likely to create problems for American foreign policy interests. And I think that if you look at the affidavits...
Well, I don't understand the government's version of why it excluded Borga to be that his speeches might create problems, just that anything he did here, his mere presence here, would create problems.
Well, I think that the government, in the case of Borja, the government's position is that his mere presence in the United States will create problems for us. And our answer to that and the answer of the Court of Appeals to that is not what Section 212A27 provides, and that is the only statutory authority that the government has cited in this case. With regard to POSTE, if you look at the affidavits concerning POSTE, either the public or classified affidavits, it's perfectly clear that the government's allegation in that case was that his presence in the United States would create problems because they didn't like what they expected him to say on Boston Commons about American Pershing missiles in Europe, and he was a person who came to that setting with great credibility because he was formerly the chief nuclear strategist for NATO, and they would prefer not to have him in this country at that time delivering that message because it made it more complicated for them to put their missiles in Europe. I don't think there's any indication that 27 permits, A27 permits a visa denial on those grounds. And in terms of the entry or presence versus activities claim, as the Court of Appeals likewise pointed out, the government's interpretation of A27 is inconsistent with the statutory scheme of the Immigration Act for a variety of reasons. One reason being that there are 33 categories of excludable aliens listed in Section 212 of the Immigration Act. Congress, by and large, has created has categories of exclusion based on status and categories of exclusion based on conduct. 212A28, which is the exclusionary provision at issue in Mandel, which says communists can't come into the country unless they get a waiver, that's a status exclusion. 212A27, with its reference to prejudicial activities, is a conduct exclusion. And the burden on the government is to show some evidence of prejudicial conduct in the United States, and there is absolutely nothing in the record to sustain that burden. As Justice Brennan also pointed out, the word activities is introduced by a phrase that says, seeks to enter to engage in activities. The word to engage, not only in the abstract, is an active verb. It doesn't make sense to read the language and say that an alien seeks to enter to engage in entry. That simply doesn't make sense. It's a grammatical proposition. But within the Immigration Act itself, the phrase to engage is a phrase that Congress used when it meant to justify, permit an exclusion based on anticipated conduct in the United States, so that the Immigration Act, for example, permits exclusion of an alien who seeks to enter to engage in espionage, seeks to enter to engage in sabotage, seeks to enter to engage in immoral sexual activities. That is the phraseology that Congress used over and over and over again in the Immigration Act and doesn't support a reading of H-27 that an alien seeks to enter to engage in the act of being present in the United States. It simply doesn't make sense. Let me say something as well about the administrative practice that the government cites. The government makes a variety of claims with regard to past administrative practice, one being that over the last 20 years, 70 million people have been issued non-immigrant visas and only 500 or 600 have been denied admission under H-27. With all due respect, that's not an argument that I understand, because to the extent that those 500 or 600 may have been improper, they remain improper regardless of the fact that 60 or 70 million other people may have properly been granted visas. In terms of concrete illustrations, and the government was questioned quite precisely about this in the Court of Appeals, how many times have you denied entry to an alien under H-27 based on an alien's entry or presence in the United States, the claim that their entry or presence would be prejudicial to American foreign policy interests? The government came up with three examples in the Court of Appeals. We, by the way, have had no opportunity for discovery, so have no idea of what contrary examples may be in the administrative record. But the government came up with three examples that Mr. Wallace has again referred to today, the example of Mr. Liao, the example of Madam Nu, the example of Otto Scarseni. Aside from the fact that all of them are at least 25 years old, Mr. Liao and Madam Nu, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals, were in fact excluded based upon anticipated activities, and that is what the correspondence submitted by the government to the district court established. In terms of Otto Scarseni, the former Nazi general, he may well have been excluded based on his status as a former Nazi. But aside from the fact that one exclusion 30 years ago is not, I don't think, probative of anything, let alone a consistent administrative practice, as Justice Scalia pointed out, in 1978, Congress amended the Immigration Act to add Section 212A33 that expressly provides for the exclusion now of former Nazis. And when they did so, both the congressional sponsors and the Justice Department itself, in a supporting letter submitted to Congress, and these can both be found in attached to the House report, referred to the fact that the Nazi exclusion provision that was added in 1978 was added to fill an existing loophole in the law that previously Congress had the administration had not had the authority to keep people out of that sort, or at least Congress didn't think they did, and Congress wanted to fill the loophole, so they passed the Nazi amendment.
Mr. Shapiro, suppose that the claim is that Section 27 permits the exclusion of an alien where his mere presence for the purpose of making speeches would endanger our foreign policy. You think Section 27 would permit that?
I don't think Section 27 permits that. Well, several things. I don't think it's what the government has alleged here. I don't think it's what
well, that isn't what I asked.
I don't think it's what 27 now says. And to the degree that it is what 27 says, then I think you'd be smack up against a significant First Amendment problem. And I don't think that there's any need to confront that problem.
Let's just stick to the statute. If the government says, well, look, his presence here for the purpose of making speeches, no matter what he says, if our allies think that he is that we're permitting him in this country to freely to go around and make speeches, that just offends them. Is that outside the reach of the statute, you think?
I think that that is outside the reach of the statute, because I don't think that this statute, with its reference to prejudicial activity, was discussing speech-making in the United States, as Justice Marshall suggested. And I think that it is for very good reason that the government has refrained from taking that position all throughout this litigation. The government has never come in from day one.
They were pretty close to it in this argument today, saying that they may consider what they are here for. They're here for making speeches.
Well, to the extent that the government's position now is that these people can be excluded because they are here to make speeches, and here to make speeches, which the government openly admits, by the way, that's not a viewpoint-neutral judgment. If your question, Justice White, is meant to suggest that the government doesn't care what these people are saying, that it is the act of making a speech while present in the United States that triggers H-27. First of all, the record itself does not support that. If you look at the classified affidavit submitted by Undersecretary Eagleburger with regard to Nino Posti, for example, it is quite clear that the State State Department's objection is that at a time that we are engaged in the critical negotiations about the deployment of American Pershing missiles in Europe, they anticipated that Nino Posti would come to the United States and tell people that those missiles were not necessary or appropriate. To the degree that the government's position is that it is that anticipated speech that justifies their exclusion under H-27, I don't think that H-27 provides that, and if H-27 provides that, I don't think that the Constitution permits that. And one
well,
of the
suppose we disagree with you on your construction of 27, that the government may deny a visa if to a person whose presence here for the purpose of making speeches would really cause the government trouble. Suppose this section covers that. Are we foreclosed from reaching that ground here?
Well, I think, Your Honor, I think that...
On what basis did the district court decide the case?
Well, that's a hard question for us to answer, as I will explain in a moment.
It's because hard for us, too. And
I'll tell you, let me give you the background of what happened, having been there since the creation.
Yeah, but what does his opinion say?
What Judge Green's opinion says is that the government may not deny visas for content-based reasons.
Right.
And having read the public affidavits submitted by Undersecretary Eagleburger, which in conclusory fashion simply recited the language of the statute, it said, I denied these visas because I determined that their admission would be prejudicial to the public interest. He said, I've read the public affidavits. They don't satisfy me. I don't know what they mean. He then entertained the government's classified affidavits in camera, ex parte, without sharing them with us. And he wrote in his opinion, because these were still ex parte classified affidavits, that I've read the affidavits and I'm convinced the government had legitimate and bona fide reasons, which he did not then explain because at that point they were still classified. That's the difficulty in understanding the district
court.
Do
you read his opinion as accepting the government's position that mere presence is enough?
I think he accepted the government's position that mere presence was enough. I do not think that the Court of Appeals accepted the position that presence is enough. And one of the things that the Court of Appeals remanded on two grounds, and one of the Court of Appeals remands was to determine exactly, their legal position was entry of presence is not enough. It looks to us from your affidavits that is why you kept these people out. But since we're sending it back for some other reasons, you might want a better opportunity to explain to the district court if you had some reasons other than entry of presence. Because the Court of Appeals likewise read the current state of the record as supporting an exclusion based only on entry of presence. The other difficulty with reading H-27 to permit exclusions based on entry of presence is that it really then does run smack up into the McGovern Amendment, which I want to just discuss for a moment. There are vastly greater numbers, or there historically have been vastly greater numbers of aliens kept out from the United States under Section H-28 and H-27. H-28 being the statute that was at issue in Mandel, which basically says if you're a member of a communist organization or if you advocate the doctrines of communism, you shall be excluded from the United States unless the Attorney General grants you a waiver. In 1977, Congress adopted the McGovern Amendment to promote the principles of the Helsinki Accords, as it states in its preambles. And what the McGovern Amendment essentially says is, we no longer want to keep people out based on this notion of guilt by association. And so notwithstanding the fact that aliens may belong to communist organizations or be affiliated with communist organizations, our presumption is they will now be admitted to the United States unless the government, the executive, is prepared to certify to both houses of Congress that national security interests are at stake. Even if you put the best gloss possible on the government's affidavits, what you will find, at least with regard to Nino Posti and the two Cuban women, is that the government's position is Acosta is a member of the World Peace Council. The World Peace Council is affiliated with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is engaged in a propaganda campaign, and therefore Posse must also be engaged in a propaganda campaign. There is no specific allegation with regard to Nino Posse that is independent of an assumption that the government made based on his organizational affiliation. He's connected to this group. This group is doing bad things, and therefore we presume that if we allow him into the country, he will do similar bad things. That is precisely our position, at least is. That is precisely the kind of leap, the kind of presumption, the kind of guilt by association that Congress meant to prohibit by the McGovern Amendment. And one of the reasons that I believe these speakers were excluded under H-27 rather than H-28, where they would have more naturally belonged, is precisely because the government didn't want to have to deal with the rigors of the McGovern Amendment, because the government was not prepared to, in fact, certify to both houses of Congress that national security would be jeopardized if Nino Posse were allowed in the United States and permitted to give the speech that he wants to give.
Argument of yours, Mr. Shapiro, is it possible that Posse's case could come out one way and then Borgi's case come out the other?
I think there are two answers to that, and this is where there are two statutory issues before the court. If the court agrees with our interpretation of H-27 that it requires activities and not mere entry or presence, then I think all these visa denials fall, Borges included. If the court concludes that entry or presence is encompassed within H-27, then I think we still have to deal with the McGovern Amendment. We would still say that the prejudice flowing from entry or presence has to really be tied to the individual, not based on organizational membership. And at that point, it may be that Borges would be in a different situation than Posse is in the two Cuban women. I mean, Borges, there is no doubt that he is a member of the Sandinista Junta. He's an official of the Nicaraguan government. Nobody disputes that. At the very least, the allegations connected to him are connected to him personally. The allegations connected to Posse and to Finley and to Lascano are connected to them because of the organizations to which they belong. And that is, we think, forbidden by the McGovern Amendment, regardless of how you decide the other H-27 question about entry or presence. Let me come back to the entry or presence issue for one more moment than just debunk this, the reliance on legislative history. The government makes a passing nod to the doctrine of plain language, that any analysis of the statute has to begin with the language that Congress has drafted. It then, for very understandable reasons, wants to get off that language as quickly as possible because it, in fact, speaks to activities and not entry or presence. And where it winds up is in the legislative history. And the government's position with regard to the legislative history, and it was a position that was echoed by Judge Bork in dissent below, is that over the 40 or 50 years that this statute has been developing, there are five or six references in committee reports to the words entry or presence, and therefore that supports the claim that when Congress referred to activities, it really meant to include entry or presence within the term activities. As we point out in our brief, if you, in fact, look at the full passages cited by the government and not the isolated phrases that I believe the government takes out of context, you will see that every reference to entry or presence is followed by a reference in the next clause or the next sentence to activities, prejudicial activities within the United States. And that on the basis of a full and fair reading of the legislative history, it seems quite clear that what Congress has been consistently concerned about in H-27 and its predecessor statutes was entry and presence to engage in prejudicial activities. And that 27, if it is linked to anything, it is more closely linked to 29. Which talks about entry to engage in sabotage or espionage. And that what Congress understood, I think, is that there are some activities that may not rise to the level of sabotage or espionage, but nonetheless are prejudicial activities. It's a very big leap to go from there to the claim that either no activities are required at all under 27, despite its language, or that the kinds of activities that Congress meant to prohibit or meant to justify a ban under 27 included speechmaking. And when you look at the statements that Senator McCarran made on the floor of the Congress when he introduced the predecessor provision in 1950, in 1952, which is when Section 212A27 was enacted, there was very little colloquy or conference language about the provision. There was more in 1950 when its predecessor's provision, the Internal Security Act, was adopted. And what Senator McCarran quite clearly says, and we cite in our brief, is that his concern, the concern of Congress, was with aliens who seek to enter or engage after entry in activities prejudicial to the public interest, and he in fact referred to the requirement of overt acts. As I have said previously, this record is totally barren of any allegation that even comes close to that. Let me raise just a few other points with you. In terms of, to come back to administrative practice for a second, the government does not make very much mention of the contemporaneous administrative record, which under standard doctrine of statutory construction is if anything, more relevant than current interpretations. And in terms of contemporaneous interpretations of A27, there are two things worth noting. One is a Board of Immigration Appeals decision in 1953 in which the government attempted to exclude a pacifist from the United States, and the Board of Immigration Appeals, 1 year after H-27 was adopted, said, no, you can't do that. You're keeping him out on the basis of status. H-27 requires activities here. He was, I think, engaged in a peacemaking speech-making tour, Justice Rehnquist. The BIA in 1953 said that is not enough under H-27. The other thing that I want to bring to the Court's attention and I say this with regret that it does not appear in either side's briefs or in the opinion by the Court of Appeals, are some 1952 regulations by the State Department on H-27, which disappeared in 1954. Since 1954, the government, the State Department, hasn't had no substantive regulations interpreting this section. But from 52 to 54, and this appears at 17 Federal Register, page 11590, December 19th, 1952. The section on H-27 says, the provision of section 212H-27 of the Act shall be considered to relate to the ineligibility of aliens to receive visas because of their purpose, plan, intention, or design, whether solely, principally, or incidentally, to engage in activities after arrival in the U.S. which would be prejudicial to the public interest or which would endanger the welfare, safety, or security of the United States. Once again, an emphasis on activities after admission, not somebody whose mere entry or presence because of their status would create difficulties for the government. Let me just wind up by making a brief comment about the First Amendment issue in this case. We raised the First Amendment claim in the district court. It was not reached by the Court of Appeals because of its interpretation of the statutory language. It is not before this court in any real and concrete way. It was not raised by the government in its cert petition. But I think it undeniable that the interpretation and application of these statutes in these cases.
Well, the government wouldn't be expected to raise in its petition, would it? The government doesn't want to claim that it violates the First Amendment.
No, what the government did, Your Honor, what the government did was in their petition, in fact, was to drop a footnote on the final page of their brief on the merits, saying that even though we have not raised the First Amendment question in our questions presented, it was reached by the dissent below, it was alleged by the plaintiffs, and therefore this court has jurisdiction and should reach out to decide it. What I'm saying is I don't think it's necessary for this court to decide the First Amendment question, but I do think that the presence of significant First Amendment claims has to affect the interpretation of the statute, and that the statute can and should be interpreted in a way that minimizes its First Amendment difficulties, and that is not the case if the statute is interpreted to permit exclusions from the United States based on a claim that an alien's substantive speeches within the United States create prejudice to American foreign policy interests. And I do not believe, as Justice O'Connor's question indicated, and I was delighted to hear the government's response, I do not believe this court by any means foreclosed the First Amendment issue in Mandel. Mandel was a case in which the excluded foreign speaker was kept out of the United States because he had violated the terms of a past visa by engaging in activities that were not permitted under that visa. Nothing in the holding of Mandel, I do not believe, even remotely suggests that the government keeps somebody out of the country because it doesn't like the speeches they are likely to give in this country, that is a facially legitimate and bona fide reason. And I think that those First Amendment considerations have to necessarily at least be part of the process of interpreting this statute to conform not only with constitutional requirements, but to conform with what I believe is the clear and obvious intent of Congress as reflected in the plain language of the statute and a fairly consistent legislative history. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Shapiro. Mr. Wallace, you have 2 minutes remaining.
The Court of Appeals referred to the legislative history of subsection 27 as interchangeably using references to entry and activities as the basis of concern, and that is entirely consistent with Judge Harold Green's saying that it is a distinction without a difference in this context, and as I tried to relate it to the text, that the thing that can be prejudicial about the activities is the entry of the proposed activities, is the entry or presence of the individual who is seeking the visa. That is the thing that can be prejudicial, rather than anything that's malum in se about the activities. That is our reading of subsection 27 and the way to reconcile it with the repeated entries to repeated references to entry or presence in the legislative history of that provision and its predecessors. The affidavits in this case, and I refer the court to Joint Appendix pages 59, 62, and 89, repeatedly say that no one is excluded from this country solely because his views are critical of our foreign policy views or in any way to deny the expression of points of view to the American people. The reason one looks to the proposed activities is to see whether they come within the narrow class for which we would admit someone without extending our general hospitality, the narrow classes that I tried to describe to you, to attend a meeting of the UN, to engage in bilateral negotiations, to get hospital treatment, etc. We can allow people in for limited purposes, but not to extend our general hospitality to them. My time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument.